Hey everyone, welcome to the Rice People Podcast. On this show, we talk to the innovators, creators, and thinkers doing some of the most interesting things in Asia. I'm Adil, and this is Wong Lei.
We dive into their journeys, learn how they think, and cover why they're doing what they're doing. We hope to provide you the inspiration and insights you need to forge your own journey. You can access all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources to keep learning at ricepeoplepodcast.com.
Our guest today is Albert Ho, Chief Strategy Officer at a cross-border social commerce startup, RateS. He also runs a Telegram group called 1-10 Scale-Up, where he shares curated US and Southeast Asia tech and startup content. Welcome to the show, Albert.
Yeah, thanks, Adieu and Wong Lei. Maybe I'll just do a short intro about myself and what RateS is, and then so that we can have the kickstart a discussion and conversation. So my name is Albert. So I graduated from NUS Business School in 2017. So this is actually my first startup and first career per se. Right. So immediately after graduation, we started this company initially in Singapore. It's called RateX. So we got the entrepreneurship practicum from NUS itself. I think it's about $10,000. Yeah, and then we got the spring grant after that. When we were still schooling, right? So RateX was originally started as a payment extension for when you're buying like Taobao, you're buying like Amazon, and then you pay credit card. So you have to pay a lot of the currency conversion fees. So about 3%. So that is what we started. So we did that in 2017 for the whole of 2017. Then we tried to expand to Indonesia actually, because Singapore is a little bit small. So we have to grow regionally lah. So when previously we already took venture capital from some Indonesian VCs. Yeah, so we tried to expand to Indonesia, and that failed in a way, because for us, our first product was a Chrome extension. So that means you buy stuff online using the browser. But in Indonesia, the whole landscape is different. First, nobody really buy a lot of cross-border stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then people actually shop on mobile. I don't think actually people even use open laptop at night.
Yeah,
not a lot of people actually do. Yeah, so, and then we pivoted a little bit. So we look at a lot of examples of social commerce in China, in India. Some examples like everyone know Pinduoduo, Yunji, Beidian, Xingcheng Yuxian in China. We look at a few of the models in India. Right, so to give everyone an introduction to what social commerce is, so most of us are familiar with e-commerce, right? So e-commerce marketplaces are like your Shopee, your Lazada, and Indonesia is Bukalapak, is Tokopedia, right? So it's where the marketplace onboards sellers, the merchants, and then us as the buyers to buy products. But in Indonesia, this has a problem, because for these marketplaces, actually, most of the volume is actually in Jakarta, Jabodetabek, which is the bigger area, which is the broader metropolitan Jakarta area. So about 70% of the GMV is in this area. So outside of this area, it's not that easy for e-commerce, because unlike us, they are not so savvy with the internet, they are not so savvy with buying products. Right, so social commerce started predominantly, it rose to fame because in China, where Pinduoduo targeted the tier 2 to tier 6 cities with groceries first. Right, and then it revolutionized gamified short commerce. So after that, in India, different models existed, reseller models. Yeah, so reseller models is basically where the reseller helps the platform to sell products to social networks and so forth. Right, and then for us, we experimented with different models in Indonesia. So in 2018, we started tweaking with this kind of research and stuff, right? And then 2019, then we started exploring Indonesia. And then so I was the first person to go over to Indonesia to set things up. And then when my team was still in Singapore, our engineers and our developers, So in 2019, we moved over to Indonesia, and then we started. So and then we found some initial product market fit, and then we sort of pivoted the whole company towards just doing this reseller social commerce in Indonesia itself. Yeah, and then we have been running in Indonesia for about close to 2 years now. 2.5 years, right? And then we closed our Series A round in 2020. Yeah. So that is the rough journey for us. And some introduction to social commerce in Indonesia, actually.
Yeah, I think that's super helpful for our listeners as well. Maybe could you, like, just to touch a little bit on the social commerce side of things, right? My understanding is there are, like, a couple of different models, like, maybe in, like, different geographies. There's, like, some which are, opinion leader-led models, some where, you know, it's just regular, like, housewives who are reselling these products, and others which is more of, like, a group buying type of solution. Yeah, I'd love to understand from you, like in terms of, Red S's model, right, which direction is it hit in, and why choose one over the other models?
Maybe I can give a bit more of a intro to the different kind of models. So your question is it's a great question, right? Because social commerce is pretty broad and pretty generic. So social commerce in US is actually more of like a TikTok, Facebook kind of social commerce, right? But in this part of the world, in China, India, Southeast Asia, so typically there's like 3 to 4 kind of different models. So you have like the influencer led model. So this is like, you know, when influencers sell products on Instagram, Facebook, or like increasingly TikTok as well. And then you have the community group buy model, which is how Pinduoduo started. But now PDD is a bit different already, right? So they started with like group buy, then you and me buy products together, and then we earn like a... usually there's like a pickup point element to it. So companies like your WeBuy, companies like your Kita Belly in Indonesia, so they group buy groceries and etc. together. Then the third model is our model. So ours is more of a reseller agent model. Then the resellers will help us as affiliate agents to sell products or services to their network and stuff. Right, and then the last one is so-called like video commerce in a way. Yeah, so it started with there is a few bigger companies in India, like DealShare, like Trail, and so forth, right, that does this kind of stuff. Actually, the model itself is like a theoretical framework, but in reality, different models do experiment with different ways. So for instance, we are experimenting with like a bit of like a group buy for certain kind of categories. We are experimenting with different kind of experiments also. So for us, we chose reseller model first because to us, that is like the initial phase to start. Because when we went to Indonesia, it's not like we are new to Indonesia because we have a lot of friends and families. And actually, my co-founders, like fiancés, are also from Indonesia. So we know like the this kind of like landscape. So in Indonesia, a lot of things are actually using like WhatsApp, using Facebook groups.
Yeah.
So fun fact, very funny story. Let's say in Jakarta, right, to book the bus, right. So they use WhatsApp group to organize last time.
Oh wow!
Or like BBM, right? So they say, oh okay, this bus is coming at this time, especially from airport to the city center. Then after that, the uncle must text the BBM group. Oh, can you go and buy this? Yeah. Then even in Indonesia, let's say even like people will always think like social commerce is for like the poorer people in a way, low economic class lah. But actually in Jakarta, even for like the rich tai, sometimes they have a WhatsApp group together or BBM last time to buy like the handbags or whatever stuff lah. Because like opinion matters a lot. So that is the kind of like dynamic that we saw, and then we are trying to replicate in a way lah. Yeah, but of course this model is still I would say very experimental. Even in China, for us we do see. This field is pretty big nascent. A lot of like innovations and the experiments are just happening in Indonesia,
And I guess I would love to understand from you, as a user, right? I just want to dig in a little bit on what it feels like to be a end user purchasing something via like a Red S agent or reseller, right? This concept of social shopping may not be so prevalent in like Singapore, maybe some of the other smaller Southeast Asian nations. So maybe could you
you through the user flow a bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So for us, as the end buyer, do not even know that we exist as a company because they interact only with the resellers. So the resellers, they do have like their own Instagram shop. They have their own, in Indonesia, people use a Facebook shop and use the WhatsApp status and WhatsApp stories a lot for some reason.
Wow.
So people
WhatsApp
actually
stories. Wow.
People actually like have a WhatsApp group of like customers that they recommend products. Then they use WhatsApp story to showcase like new products and so forth. Yeah. So these resellers they get the products from us, but then they actually drop ship to the customer. Yeah, so they don't buy stock and whatever to hold. Yeah, so and then they market it as if the products are their own. Yeah, so they don't. So the customer don't even know that we exist. So for the reseller, right? So what they do is they, you know, they just have to be a little bit better in like sales and marketing. Have a little bit, be a little bit more hardworking, right? Just publish products on their WhatsApp story, on their Instagram shop, on their Instagram stories, and so forth. And then the end buyer. You know, we chat with the reseller. Oh, is this product available? Blah, blah blah. Can you show me some like real photos, reviews, or some videos? Then the reseller will like, you know, just chat with the customer. So it's a little bit different from like Shopee, because Shopee, right, you don't actually talk to the merchant that much. Like. It's more like a, you know, you want to buy something and then you go online to search, or like during their flash sale and then you browse a bit. Yeah, but in this case, it's like, you know, as if your friends are like recommending you products per se. Like for instance, I recommend you a new podcast headphone or like a new mic. Maybe you might buy it more, you know.
Yeah,
this kind of like dynamics that we are trying to capture. Yeah.
Got it. And one last question. I just want to understand the fundamental part of it.
Of course.
Could you just talk us through like what are the key value proposition or the benefits that each of the stakeholders see, right? So you have the merchant itself, you have the reseller, agent, and then you have the customer, right? Could you like help us understand like how each person benefits in this social commerce relationship?
Yeah, so in this relationship, actually there are four parties in the value chain. Okay. So you have the suppliers who produce the products, and then we onboard them onto the platform, right? So that is the supplier of the products. And then you have the RateS itself, right, as the unifying platform in a way. And then you have the resellers, and then you have the end customers. So for the end, for the suppliers, of course, it's two benefits. So first is, you know, increased sales. You don't really care, right? You just sell the products, and then you just buy it at cost price, whatever, increased sales. And then the second is benefit for these suppliers is we actually give them a lot of like feedback on the, like, you know, oh, you know, actually this taste is better, this color is better, this da-da-da is better. So we, in a way, we work with them to, you know, improve certain product offerings to tailor to, oh, you know, in Jakarta, actually they like this thing. In Medan, actually this taste is better. Actually, yeah, so it's free feedback and stuff. Yeah, of course they would love it. So for us, we earn a bit of like a cut from these products. Yeah, and then, so we are a startup. So we do try to build like this kind of like data loops. Right? This the entire value chain, feedback loops and stuff. Then the third is for the reseller. So we don't dictate that the price that they set to the customers. So we allow them to set their own commissions to the customers and so forth. And then for us, we also reward them by giving them some sales bonus if they hit certain targets. Yeah. Then for the customers itself, so these customers, right, they are not that tech savvy per se. So this is a way for them to introduce them to e-commerce in a way. Because for some of them, they don't even know what is the shopping cart button for, right? I mean, you know, they wouldn't even download like Tokopedia or Shopee to try and use. Yeah, they don't know what is like e-commerce delivery. They don't trust this. But if the reseller recommend them products, if the reseller, you know, tell them that, okay, actually this product is good, I've used it before, here are some photos, here are some videos, then they are more willing to try. Yeah, so it is a way for them to get, you know, organic reviews of products from their trusted friends and family. That's why so in theory this is the benefits for all four parties in the value chain itself.
That's super cool. That element of trust that the end user, right, like you're technically like leveraging the trust they have in these resellers, right, because it's probably their friends or someone that they look up to or recognize
Exactly. So this trust is, it might feel a bit foreign for us if you know, we come in with the lens of like from a Singaporean lens, because we are familiar with like Shopee, we are familiar with Lazada and so forth. So we don't usually use this kind of stuff that much. But actually when you think about yourself as a Singaporean, like, you know, when you see people post stuff on IG stories, you actually trust these reviews a bit more, right? Because your taste and preference of your friends and related are quite similar to yours. Yeah, and then so typically for me, when I was buy like a headphone, I actually post on IG stories to ask for recommendations and so forth. Yeah, then you relate this back to like the context in Indonesia, but the products are not as expensive. So we sell products like cheaper fashion, household cleaning kit, household cooking sets, yeah, this kind of things that are a bit more suited to their kind of like lifestyle. Yeah. Mm.
Oh yeah, I wanted to say no wonder, just now I was trying out the app, I managed to set up my own store within 5 minutes.
And yeah.
I think that was really amazing. And a lot of moments where I find it very delightful and very surprising. So I think the product design is really very amazing.
Yeah, actually maybe I can share a little bit more about this experience. So when we started like 2 years ago, right, to me, building an e-commerce platform is, I thought it wasn't that hard, lah, honestly. As in, it's just, you know, I just link supplier and link buyer. I onboard the seller, onboard the buyer. It's very simple. But actually, when we started building, right, then we realized actually how tough is it to build something like a Shopee, especially on the backend side, lah, you know, and then the whole thinking about the stuff and yeah. Yeah, so, it's tough, lah.
Mm. Actually, can you share more? Like, were there any, how to say, like, breakthrough moments that helped the team to arrive at the product experience that I experienced just now? Like,
yeah, of course. Okay. So, to tell the truth, so our reseller give us so much feedback on where to improve. I think our roadmap, maybe for the next 2 years, we can just, it's set already. So for us, okay, maybe 2 years ago when we start, right, it was a very bare bones. So it was so bare bones that we didn't even charge like a shipping fee and stuff, because we just didn't design, we didn't know that it was so complex. So we did the, you know, the lean startup methodology, just launch, get feedback. It was so poor, then we had so much complaints and stuff. Then we improved along the way for these 2 years. Now we have a quarterly product cycle, so we improve our features. So we know, like, for this quarter what we are going to build for the next 2 quarters is already kind of like set in stone, because we gauge them from the intensity and of the feedback. Yeah, so there is a lot of like complaints and feedback that the resellers give us and improve. So it's quite easy for us to validate what to build per se. Yeah, which is good and bad, because we don't have to think about what to build. As in, it's so crucial that they keep pinging us, means it's probably very important to them. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. There was one feature that I thought was very puzzling. When I click on a link that I sent to a customer, it shows me two buttons. One is chat with the seller, and the other one is a shopping cart button. And I thought it would be like add to cart. That's what I'm used to. But instead, it says chat with seller.
Correct.
So I finally realized why.
Yeah. So actually, it's a half-finished feature. So by right, if I send you the link, the shopping shop link, you should be able to check out by yourself. But actually, we haven't... So our initial thesis was, we don't want the customer to check out themselves, because we want the customer to always chat with the reseller so that the reseller can convince the customer to buy more and to increase the conversion rate per se. Yeah. So that was the thinking at the start. But then after like 6 to 9 months of launching, then our reseller have been telling us that, you know, actually it's way better for the buyer and customer to be able to check out themselves, so that they don't have to constantly guide the buyer on like what to buy, what to sell, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So in short, that feature, that shop is still an unfinished feature, lah. We still haven't finished the checkout function yet. Yeah.
That's a very fascinating story.
Yeah.
We know. But yeah. I mean, I couldn't tell.
But the thesis was that, you know, like, now you have a lot of shops like Shopify, right? But Shopify is actually still a bit complex to use. Yeah. And then you have to know how to find the products, you have to know how to customize the theme, you have to know how to customize your domain name, do SEO, do marketing, blah, blah, blah. Then what we aim to do that is to do a Shopify light version. Then you don't have to think about all these things. You don't have to get products. You don't have to know how to do SEO and do all this customization nonsense. Just use our app. We give you a shop link already. Yeah.
Sweet. And maybe just to zoom out a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
I think you mentioned earlier, right, like you were the first person from like Red S that went to Indonesia to set up shop there. Would love to understand, like, when you first tried to enter the market, what are some of the key challenges or the key difficulties that you found, right? Especially as a startup that was not founded in Indonesia itself, yeah. But that would eventually become your biggest market.
Right. So actually, before I even graduated, I already know that I will work in Indonesia in some capacity. So the whole process was actually starting in Indonesia as a foreigner is pretty complex because they have a lot of foreign ownership rules, they have a lot of other issues, so forth. So we had like our law firm that helped us do all the legal stuff. That even that was quite troublesome because Indonesia right now actually still is quite papers driven. In a way, like, you know, you have to have hard copy of the documents, have wax signature and so forth. So especially for like legal documents, so we had to fly over to Indonesia quite often or like courier over the documents here and there. So I went over there, I discussed with the lawyers how to set up and so forth. Then we didn't even also didn't have an office, so we managed to use like some co-working desks here and there. We didn't really tap on like headhunting services and so forth to start our first employee. So we used like Glints to get like the staff to get candidates like at the start to like ops people, CS people and so forth. Yeah, and then a lot of the other things we had to do it by brute force, you know. Because I think if I can restart again, I would actually before I even start, I would talk to more people first. Especially talk to like Singapore, Indonesian founders who then I can cut short a lot of like learning mistakes, which is why I started the 1-10 scale up thing. Because after I went through this thing, I realized that, you know, actually a lot of these mistakes can be shortened in a way. Yeah, just that I previously didn't have the networks to do so. I didn't have the right people to actually ask. I don't even know what the questions to ask. that's the problem. So that we did a lot of mistakes when we first launched, so that's why it's quite challenging at the start.
And could you give us like a high level overview of like how was that e-commerce or social commerce landscape, you know, when you first arrived, and how is it today? I'm sure today it's much more mature, there's multiple companies trying, but how was it at the start versus like today? Was that behavior already there?
So it's important to note that like what I mentioned, so this social commerce behavior is not new. So previously in the past, you know, there is like Tupperware, there's like MLM stuff in Indonesia. It's quite big previously. So this kind of behavior is always there. But then what these startups are trying to do is to add in a bit of like a more tech angle to it, make it a bit more like formalized as compared to like all this informal thing that's happening on like Facebook group or like those Kaskus, all those online forums and stuff. So when we first started like 2 years ago, there were actually only one other startup that is doing this, called Evermoss. So they started this in 2018 or so. Then so that was like 2.5 years ago already. Then I think over the past 2 years, not sure if it's due to like the tech boom in like India that's, you know, profitably leading to this rise in Indonesia, but then we do see a lot of like startups seed stage or early stage A of social commerce in Indonesia, which is good and bad for us. I mean, for any other company, because, you know, it shows that there is like interest, there is a sort of like a demand per se. Yeah, but it's bad in a way that, you know, it's not that easy to convince investors of like the real differences between us and them, because to them, social commerce is just social commerce, right? The your numbers matter, the different like operational differences don't really matter as much.
And then I guess speaking to a lot of Indonesia startups and like e-commerce startups or even social commerce companies, I guess one challenge I always hear about is like logistics, right? Like, because it's a very disparate geography, many islands, many cities, different concentrations at different areas. How have you guys tackled this problem?
I add a little bit more context to the problem. So, I always like to link it to Singapore. So Singapore, you pay for last mile, right? Let's say you're on Shopee or on Lazada. Last mile maybe costs like $1, $2 thing, right? And that is okay for us, you know, like, we are okay to pay that because that is considered like normal. So in Indonesia, adding a bit more detail. So let's say in Jakarta to Jakarta, then the price might be 70 cents to 90 cents, right? So this is okay also. But let's say if you send products from Jakarta to, let's say, somewhere in Makassar or in Papua, maybe that's like $2, $3. And then that is for like 1 kg worth of goods, and this price, right, to me is still considered okay-ish, right? But actually, to a lot of like the Indonesians, especially in those areas in like other Makassar, this where people are not as affluent as people in Jakarta, then this price shipping cost is actually quite a lot. Yeah. So this, when people talk about how the last mile issues in Indonesia, they're talking about this last mile cost, because for marketplaces, most of the merchants and suppliers are still largely based in like Jakarta, based in Surabaya. So, you know, that's why you have a lot of like city e-commerce within the city. But when you try to target like buyers in like Medan, far away area, it's quite crazy to ship things from Jakarta to Medan. So sometimes the logistics cost is quite pricey. Yeah, so the way we try to think about this is, there's a reason why group buying has been quite getting some traction, because the theory makes sense, right? You bulk buy products to this area and then you distribute internally, it makes sense. Yeah, so that is something that we have been experimenting with also, because bulk buy, group buying means instead of sending orders per piece, you group them in one order and then you send them, ship them together to a person's house, for instance, or like a shop. Then everyone go there and pick up, or from there you use the domestic logistics in the area to send the goods. Yeah, so in theory this thing makes sense, but in reality it is still a bit tricky because Singapore is very small, but in Indonesia is insanely huge. So when you talk about group buy, to organize this is a little bit tricky lah. So we are still doing it like step by step, trying to solve this piece. Yeah, but if there's any company that can solve this, I think it's quite a big opportunity, but it's definitely tough lah, because it's just too big, too broad. Yeah.
Yeah, because we talk about the logistics, I actually want to ask about the payment. What's the payment infrastructure like in Indonesia right now? Because I was trying out the app. Actually, you offer like you can pay via RedS, you can pay via the traditional methods like PayPal, credit card. You also offer like cash on delivery.
Yeah.
So what is the state right now in Indonesia and how are you guys like tackling the challenges?
Actually, we try not to tackle this whole piece by ourselves. So actually, we work with this payment provider called Zendit. So what they do is they aggregate all these payment methods like bank transfer, e-wallet, like Shopee Pay, OVO, Dana, other methods lah. So what we do is we work with this payment provider so that we don't have to open a bank account ourselves. We don't have to do XXX ourselves. Yeah. So then for cash on delivery, we do it ourselves through like a partnership with the delivery courier. Yeah, so actually I'm not sure if you guys use cash on delivery in Singapore. I personally don't use that. But in Indonesia it's pretty big actually. Okay, for a few reasons, because people don't some people might not trust the quality of the good, so some people might not think that the order might even come. So that's why they use cash on delivery. Then the most common payment methods is still bank transfer and cash on delivery. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yep.
So
it's that lack of trust again with the with the merchants and the delivery people.
Yeah. So actually in a lot of areas in Indonesia, the city area is no issue, right? People know how to use mobile banking, people know how to use e-wallet like OVO, Dana, Shopee Pay. But in some areas they have to actually walk like 1-2 km. They actually have to travel by 1 hour lah, to get to an ATM to even make payment. So that's why in this places we try to build our own wallet, we try to have cash on delivery service so that we can offer this payment to them. If not, it's really quite tough like, you know, I have to travel like 1 hour to ATM to do more banking, I have to travel 1 hour to a convenience store to make payment and stuff. That's something that I've seen also.
And I guess coming from someone with your experience in this social commerce space, right, starting a company and building it up to the size is it is today, I was wondering if you could maybe share your perspective on like why this social commerce phenomenon, right, like initially was very big in like China and India, like with Meesho and all this, right? Then why did it take so long, I guess, for like developed Western markets to adopt this method of commerce as well, right?
So I that's something that I pondered over also, but maybe you're talking about, you know, why did it take so long for, let's say, Facebook or whatever to do commerce tools and apps in the US, for instance? I think the main reason is because of, to me, I think it's because of Amazon. Because I actually was in US for like 1 year for my NOC program. There is really not that much need for social commerce per se, because Amazon was just too powerful, too available, too good to use previously. Then the social commerce in that case take the form of other aspects. So for instance, there are companies like Poshmark, there are companies like the original one is like Craigslist and some other, somehow Craigslist morph into other areas. So we don't see such behaviors as much in US or in Europe actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so social commerce, yes, but it's still based on how Instagram, WhatsApp, Shopify, TikTok is evolving. But in India, in China, in Indonesia, that's where we see, you know, players like us that is trying to carve out this niche in a way. Yeah. In Europe, in US, it's just people are a little bit more educated, a little bit more affluent, and that's why I think this affects, like, you know, how shopping is, I guess. Yeah.
And I guess they also trust everything, right? They trust the platform, they trust the payments, they trust the logistics. It's all there already. Versus
exactly.
Can you share more about the gamification elements on the platform? And I think there's one feature that I was very fascinated with, is the team feature. Like, you can join as a team member and you get more perks. You also can join as a team leader, you get even more perks. So I thought that's all very interesting.
Yeah, the question is, right, so I think before we dive into this, I think we can ask, like, why does platforms like Shopee or Pinduoduo build gamification? Yeah, so it is like a means to keep you in the app. It is a means for you to, you know, find fun to do shopping, right? So that, you know, then you spend more time on the app, they are able to excite you to browse more products in a way. Yeah, so that is our, we try to, like, work backwards. Yeah, then for us, it is a way to solve two problems. Actually, educating and acquiring reseller is not easy for us also, because it's not simple to teach people to learn how to use the app, learn how to market online, learn how to sell the product. So that is something very challenging for us. So that's why we did this team system, so that we onboard like leaders, and then they can onboard their own kakia to, or minions to go and sell things. Yeah. So we incentivize the team leaders to, you know, get referral, blah blah, and get educate their own reseller. Yeah, so it's a bit like MLM, but just one level in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super cool. Makes sense. I can imagine it's like, because of the size of the country and all that, like, and maybe like the tech literacy in the country, it may be very hard to, like, you know, use traditional tech platforms to teach them how to use, or just use videos and all that. Right? So they probably need some level of handholding or physical person to teach them, right?
We can't scale our team to do this handholding, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So we had to decentralize this to people who are willing to teach, who are willing to mentor for a bit of money. For us, we don't have much gamification, but that is because we don't have enough. It's too far away in the product roadmap.
Yeah.
We need to solve our core problem first, then we will think about gamification. But in the future, we will have like team-based quests, team-based targets, team-based that is the whole vision for us in actually absolutely. 1-2 years. Yeah.
Focus on yourself a little bit.
Of course,
your current role is as a chief strategy officer at Rate S, right?
Yeah.
And I guess in terms of CXO titles, it's probably not the most well known. Mm. Could you maybe like just share a little bit about what's your role as chief strategy officer, right? What do you do? What are some metrics for success for a chief strategy officer, right? Yeah.
That is a question I try to answer every day when I wake up also. I think to me, maybe I can give a bit more context to me and my co-founders. So we know each other through army actually. We went to NUS together, we went to NOC together. So we know each other for very long. I think 11 years already. So my CEO is the main person who looks upwards and outwards. Mainly the guy that does fundraising, investor relations, and so forth. So for me, it is a mix of both, like a COO role, CFO role, and commercial role. Basically, everything that is more internal facing and more operational facing, more finance facing, and so forth. Yeah. So we don't split the matrix so distinctly because at our stage now, anyway, for our company size, we have about 15 people in Singapore. So mostly engineers and product managers. We have about 80 people in Indonesia, spread across different islands and different regions. So for us, we are still very small. So so for me, there isn't much KPI per se. As long as the company exists with cash, the company can find investors, then that is our KPI. So all the business related stuff I will handle especially.
I think we also like to ask this question of like people who lead startups and early stage companies, right? Like what do you think are some of like these key skill sets that you have that I guess help you excel at the role you are doing now, right? I think it can serve as like good lessons for people who are thinking of like starting their own companies or even people who are in similar roles today, right?
Yep, understand. So maybe I can split this into for me it's on how to hire the right people. I think that is quite important for me. And then the second is how to always show empathy and trying to grow. Okay, so for the first example, how to hire the right people. So it's very tough at the start in Indonesia because you don't really know how it works and so forth. So I actually don't know how sales work in Indonesia. So maybe this could be useful. So in Indonesia, it's so big that, you know, big companies actually have a lot of offline salespeople. Like they call them like city managers, and then they call them like area managers. So they split them into offline territory to manage. And Indonesia, you really need the offline presence. Like, you know, a lot of it is on trust, relationship. So our team actually have to meet the resellers pretty often on the ground to, like, you know, build this relationship, meet the suppliers, drink some tea money, drink some kopi here and there. On the ground, really.
Diabetes, man.
Yeah. So, drink this kind of stuff, smoke together. So at the start, it was tough because I didn't even know, I know this exists, but I didn't know how to set this up. Yeah, so I use LinkedIn a lot. I talk to a lot of, like, recruiters. I talk to a lot of operators on the ground, then to hire, to start building up this sales force on the ground. Then as I hire more and more local Indonesians, then they give me more and more insights. That's where I start to, that's where the organization structure of the company start to develop. Yeah, and then they brought in more referrals, and so that is the most important, learning how to talk and hire the right people. Yeah, and actually most people are very willing to share their knowledge and so forth, like just a LinkedIn request. And more importantly, it's the network. So that's why I keep thinking the 1 to 10 scale is quite important, because a lot of people do ask me for advice now, which I'm happy to share. Yeah. Then the second thing is on showing empathy and understanding. So what I mean by this is, a lot of foreign founders actually want to set things up in Indonesia, want to set a local team, and then issue them like KPI, ask them to, you know, solve the KPI, hit the KPI, and then like give them bonuses and stuff. But to me, that doesn't really work, because Indonesian is a lot based on like trust, based on relationships. So you have to show that you are, you know, you are with them, you respect their culture, which is also why I had to learn Bahasa. Then after I learned Bahasa, you know, they really respect me for the effort. It's just get way better. And then they don't see you as a outsider, as a foreigner. You know, you show the effort, they respect it. I also go with them on the ground to like visit the reseller, visit the supplier. Then this helps to build like trust, I guess, even in like my own team, my own employees towards myself. Yeah. So I'm more of the on the ground, like kind of like leader per se.
Cool. I realize in this conversation, there's a lot of the word trust is mentioned a lot, right? Both even within your organization, but also within you and your resellers, and then your resellers and their customers. And yeah, super cool.
Yeah.
And maybe just, we'd love to also talk about some stuff beyond RateS and TechRite. Since at least from what I can tell about you, we're looking at your content and all that, you love talking about like tech stuff, startups and all these kinds of things. We first would love to understand like why did you start this 1 to 10 scale up newsletter and Telegram group? I think you briefly touched on it earlier, but we'd love to understand like your own thought process behind creating this.
So I think for me, I actually learned a lot from US-based tech content. like TechCrunch, a lot of like newsletters, a lot of Substack and stuff by US people, but they are not that, sometimes not that applicable to like Southeast Asia. And I tried to Google, I tried to YouTube, I don't see anything online for this kind of, this side of the world. Like I mean, increasingly there are some for like China, but the like real
Southeast
thing
Asia,
in, yeah correct the real thing in China is not online, it's actually in like WeChat, in your other Toutiao or stuff lah. In Southeast Asia there isn't any, I'm not sure why. So that's why I thought that, and then a lot of this content are not enough content for Southeast Asia, not enough operational content for startups per se. A lot of content is like the theory, you know, retention is important, but how do you, what exactly is retention, how do you build a cohort analysis, how do you improve retention, a lot of theory like CAC LTV is important. No one really knows what this means actually, so I aim to like, you know, use my experiences to try to teach people how to do it and so forth. That is the two main context for 1 to 10 scale up. And then the third main benefit is that I benefited a lot from like my own networks and connections previously. I want to do something, I want to get a link, get a partnership with OVO, I talk to my NOC friends, I can link up with someone. But so I want, and a very cliche way is to like bring it forward lah, to like, you know, we help each other, make our life a bit easier.
I think it's super cool, all this kind of I think sometimes the key benefit that putting out this kind of, I guess, creator stuff, content, it's not like the immediate stuff, like this, the benefits will, you know, come in like maybe 1-2 years down the road, you know, some serendipitous meeting with someone that, oh, I also followed you on your this thing, and then maybe, yeah, I don't know, yeah, to me that's how it always happens, like that's why we also do this podcast and all this writing stuff and all these kinds of things, right?
I'm very curious about how YouTubers, right, actually managed to build a million subscriber YouTube channel. Overarching advice is you always need to do at least 52 videos first.
Consistency.
Then after that, you find your niche, you improve, and then you manage to people will actually follow. People actually follow content whether you know it or not. Like for instance, I didn't know people actually follow my stuff until this person tell me this, you know, you've been following this podcast, sorry, this Telegram channel. They asked me for like some advice on what is product management, how to improve in product management. And I thought that was interesting, right? And then so that, I thought that was like quite interesting also.
Meeting new people is always fun.
of course. And now I think to building a startup is tough lah. Don't need to make it even tougher, right? Just build it with friends, ask for advice, ask for people help, make things a bit easier.
I'm also curious, right? What are some key lessons you have learned from doing a newsletter and then starting a Telegram group?
I give a bit more context onto the Telegram group. I like to read this kind of stuff. And then when I read this kind of stuff, I like to discuss with people. So I always share it to my company people, I share it to my friends. But most people, they don't actually like to read this kind of stuff. Or they don't like to, you know, think about this kind of stuff. So that's why I thought about, you know, creating a channel. Then people interested will naturally gravitate towards such stuff lah. So I think some lessons I learned is that actually now I try to plan content ahead. Then I have a content calendar actually. Then increasingly I'm trying to do like video content, I'm trying to do more writing also.
No, I mean, I'm just curious, like what's the biggest challenges you face, right? Like even for myself or even us making this podcast sometimes is that because all three of us, I think in the daytime we have a full-time job as well. You know, limited hours to do all this extra creation, even though it's things we enjoy, right? And I totally get your point, right? Like I also love reading all this TechCrunch and I subscribe to like 99 newsletters but no one else wants to chit chat about this kind of thing with me, right? So that's why I also joined your group. It's like very fun and see, and get exposed to more of this type of content. But I wonder for yourself, like have you felt any, like, I guess you're sort of like a creator-ish nowadays also, so like any challenges on that front? Like always curious to learn from other people who are also putting out stuff.
I think your main question is actually, let's say after work at night, should you watch Netflix or should you do this kind of
thing? Yeah, it's so, a question I ask every day.
Yeah, so it should. I think don't need to hustle so much because I mean, if you really want to watch Netflix, then just watch Netflix. Just let your mind relax and so forth. I think that's the main lesson I actually have, because I actually also suffer from this. Oh no, actually now I'm taking coding. I'm learning Basa also, and then I realized that my time is quite stretched, and then I don't want to punish myself. You know, if I really not in the mood to write like the some stuff or like create some videos, then just don't do it. Then just wait till you know, procrastinate a bit. Let your have some mental wellness for a while. Then, you know, when you have inspiration, things will just flow naturally. When you're in the flow zone,
And then maybe just to touch on one of the articles you had written about, right, which is was about the passion creator economy, which is a space I'm super passionate about. I'm just curious, like, I guess especially as someone based in you know, Southeast Asia as well, like, how do you view this space, like, in Southeast Asia? Like, there's a lot of content about, you know, the growth in like developed markets and all the 1,001 startups that are coming up to serve the creator economy for people to create content in those markets, but how do you feel it's developing in Southeast Asia?
So actually, for me, I always thought this creator thing economy will bloom in Southeast Asia, because I do see it in China actually, but just that right now it is not the right time per se. I would say I would say it's still slowly coming up lah. Because I mean after a while, Southeast Asia is still quite diverse. You wouldn't watch someone in Thailand who is speaking Thai per se, or someone in Don. So, you know, in each market, you still see such example. Right now, I don't see much such stuff in Singapore or in Indonesia. I mean, don't have, but I do see people who are trying to build influencer management agencies in Indo. They base it on like China. China has a huge live streaming industry and stuff. So I do see people who's trying to start this kind of thing in Indo already. Yeah. Especially with like TikTok and stuff, you know, it gets way more easier. But right now I don't see any big companies yet. But we'll see, I think. I feel that it is predominantly still due to income. Because I mean, if for you to talk about all this creator stuff, the creator and the audience have to be of a income class lah. I mean, you have to have all these are not necessities. Then I think Indonesia, maybe in Jakarta, maybe yes, but even so, it's still a little bit too small. Probably a few years, I guess.
That's very true, right? If you think about it, both the creator, if they want to do this consistently, they need to make money from it. But at the same time, the consumers, do they have the income to pay for like all these subscriptions and whatnot to these various creators and what, right? Okay, makes sense.
I want to unwind a bit. So just now we talk about like your lessons and the skill sets that you have to learn as you build your startup. My question is, what were things that you have to unlearn as you were building your startup?
So previously my experience is in consulting and venture capital. So that is good and bad, because bad, good in the sense like you can think in a certain structured way. You build the perfect financial model first. You build the perfect operational model. Okay, then you see the company as numbers on the Excel sheet, on the slides. But in reality, it's not that easy, because people have incentive problem, right? Oh, Indonesia, they have to be bonuses. People are not as intrinsically motivated to help you achieve your company goal. So that is things that I have to think about it. So whenever I talk to my Indonesian team, they always have to remind me, you know, not to be so, not to have my head in the cloud lah. Like, you know, basically have to be on the ground, right? You have to know how is it happening. You have to go for coffee chat with the suppliers to talk about the problem. Can't always see things from a Excel sheet perspective. Can't always see things from a, you know, problem solving perspective. That is the main insight that I actually learned. So it's just to, you know, treat people with respect, empathize with them, be on the ground solving problem with them, enjoy like a cup of tea with them, or don't smoke with them lah, but you know. this kind of lessons. So like, it's always having like hits in the cloud when you talk to investors, feet on the ground when you know go out with your team and so forth.
Well, that's such a nicely phrased concept. I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something I learned. And I think not to be too elitist, but in Singapore, actually, we do have a good education system, and people are, and most people, or like most uni grads and most employees are actually quite qualified and quite analytical and quite capable in like math, in numbers and data per se. But in my experiences, because Indonesia is so big, so actually the education level really differ. The universities really, there's so many universities, and then the quality of the candidates really differ. So a lot of like things we take for granted in Singapore, like, you know, understanding data trends, basic math, it's not as, or even using Excel, it's not as common in Indonesia. So if you want things to be very structured, to be very analytical, it's a bit of a challenge sometimes. Yeah.
I see. Mm. Okay. Oh, I have another question.
Yeah, sure.
Actually, I think today we are like very excited. We're talking faster than usual. my question is, because just now you said if you were to unwind, there were a lot of questions that you should have asked. Then because right now I'm, I guess, in a much earlier stage of building my startup. So for someone earlier in the journey, right, how do you figure out what are the questions to ask? Yeah, because that's very important, right? In a way, asking the right questions.
Mm. So for me, I think something that I always do is to poke around on LinkedIn a lot. For instance, so what I do is I will go on LinkedIn, I will see, browse around for like Tokopedia, Shopee, the roles of the people there, the Indonesian locals there. Oh, you know, why is there this, what is this city manager role? What is their job responsibility? What is the org structure of Tokopedia or Shopee? Then I try to piece together this this map lah. So that I know what is missing per se. What is this role? What are they doing? How is this crucial to the company? Yeah, so that is also how I discovered that, oh, actually, you know, in Indonesia, it's so big that you need to really split the whole area, split the whole island, split the whole cities, and then conquer by like a city by city per se. So that is one of the big insights that I learned from. Then the second is obviously talking to people who have done it before. Yeah, because actually, to be honest, your question is quite broad per se. So it is a bit hard for me to answer. So I think one thing to do is to learn how to maybe ask like more specific questions. Because sometimes the people that I ask advice from, they actually don't know how to give me advice, but they have so much things in their head. So I always have to ask very specific questions, and then they can give me the specific advice for my specific context. Yeah, because advice is quite easy to give lah, but good advice is a bit hard to give. You have to ask great questions, then the good advice will come, I think. So I think that is my take on this whole issue, I guess.
Oh, I love it. In a way, it's like I ask a bad question, so now I know how to ask a better question.
No, you ask a very broad question, I think. Yeah. So that's why I could tell you that my generic broad answer is to go on LinkedIn to see what people, what people are doing. Then you will understand really what is the lag, I guess.
Sweet.
And the key thing is to ask more contextualized, give context to your questions, then that will really help you get better advice.
Yeah, because ultimately you as a founder, you want good actionable advice. You don't want people to give you very generic fluff advice. Oh, you know, build a good team.
That's right.
Have good employee retention. How do you do that? You can't do that, right? You need to have specific questions, specific answers, then that would be most useful, in my opinion. Yeah.
Superb. And one last question is there any like amazing piece of content that you've read recently that you think our listeners should read as well? It can be like an article, a book, a piece of video, movie.
I think one book that I read quite recently is this book called Amazon Unbound. I'm not sure if you guys heard of it before, but you know, most autobiography or like most biographies of the companies are quite generic. They talk about very fluff stuff, talk about, oh, you know, how good the company culture is, how the company certain thing. But I thought this book was quite detailed in going into like the challenges that they have, and then how they started Kindle, how they started the Amazon free shipping thing and so forth. So especially for me, because I deal with like e-commerce and logistics, so it's quite relevant for me. And honestly, then I start to appreciate the challenges that they have. So for instance, one example is, you know, in theory, you always have to be an innovative company. You have to have experiments and blah, blah, blah. But when you think back to running the context of the company, it's tough because, how do you answer to your VCs? How do you answer to your team when experiments fail? It's not easy, lah. You know, it's easy to say to be innovative, but what if you miss your revenue target, you're running out of cash? How do you really be innovative, per se? How do you have like resolve to put in the money on your bets? That was quite a good book for me at least to learn about certain things.
Heard a lot about it, but haven't gotten around to reading it. I know he says something like, as the company grows bigger, like the bets you take should also grow bigger, right? So that even if you like burn, you know, like at Amazon size, like you burn $1 billion on an experiment of like a Fire Phone or something, it's fine because it will help to create like 6-7 other products that from the learnings of that failure.
Yeah,
because
the ROI must be there. So if you spend $100,000 on an experiment, I don't know how big is the, what's the result the experiment will bring. But $1 billion is okay.
And I think that's a good place to end the our conversation. But before we wrap this up, Albert, is there anything you would like to plug?
I guess you can join my 1-10 skill up channel. Yeah. I will share more like operational knowledge per se. And actually, I'm doing a course on like scaling a startup with my friend who is building the cohort based course. Yeah, so I'll go deep into, you know, how to build like an operational model, how to build a financial model, how to think about retention and cohort analysis and so forth. Yeah. So, but more importantly is I just want to, you know, build a community where we of like operators and founders, where we really discuss the things beyond the theory and then applicable in Southeast Asia also.
Super. And well, Albert, this has been so fun. Always wanted to chat since connecting and following your very active LinkedIn for some time. Really appreciate all the time and the insights and also sharing your story today. Yeah.
Thank you guys.
If you like what you heard, please help us subscribe, rate and review. Let us know what you think and tell us who else you want on the pod.
You can go to risepeoplepodcast.com where you can find every episode of this podcast complete with transcripts and show notes. Thank you for listening and we'll catch you next week.